Blog Talk Radio.
Our community have become toxic waste. And those in high places are planning to remove the toxic waste. And while we flitter and live this frivolous, foolish life, seeking pleasure from our bodies and pleasure from the bodies of others, and seeking to be famous and wealthy in this world, to be used by the power to make our people think that if you go to school and work hard, you too can be successful. That's a lie. I don't give a damn how many of you go to school and work hard. They select a few out of the mass to deceive the rest that this house is not your house. And you are going to have to think about a house of your own, because white America, listen to me good, man, cannot support you any longer. White America cannot give jobs to her millions of unemployed, much less ours. Did you hear me? Elijah Muhammad told us in the 60s we should pool our resources and get farmland, because there is no freedom without land. You remember those teachings? He said that the time of separation had come, and that we are going to have to think about building a nation of our own. You, in the 60s, you were ready to say, it's nation time. You don't say that no more. Because you have been deceived into thinking that inclusion into this is your salvation. This that you want to be included in has no future. None.
Greetings and assalamu alaikum. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Time to Leave Blog Talk Radio Show. As we continue in this unprecedented year of 2020, we see that the best and only solution is becoming more and more obvious, that the two peoples cannot live together in peace, that is black and white. And there's been enough time to test that opinion, and we see the results today. So this show is a discussion of how we can move to have our own societies, and how we can move to have a separate community so that we can live in peace and security. Our host for tonight is Sister Anne, and she's interviewing two guests, Sister Linda Muhammad of St. Croix and Brother Keith Muhammad of Bermuda. Sister Anne, I see your number. If you can press the 1 on your dial, Sister Anne, to go to the top of my queue. And Sister Linda and Brother Keith, if you all can press the 1 on your keypad so that you can go to the top of the queue. And so, Sister Anne, I'm going to open your mic.
Okay.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Anne.
Wa alaikum salam. How are you?
I am well, by the grace of Allah. Yourself?
I'm doing fine.
Good, good. And both of your guests are on the line.
All right. Great. Great.
Assalamu alaikum, Brother Keith, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Linda.
Wa alaikum salam, sir.
Assalamu alaikum. Okay. What's the noise, Brother Carlton?
It's getting better.
It's somebody stopped now. Okay. Okay, well, tonight we have on two individuals, Sister Linda from St. Croix and Brother Keith from Bermuda.
Yes, ma'am.
They're going to be talking to us about the difference and the advantages of living on the island as they are. Self-controlled and without all of the rigmarole and violence that we have to put up with here in the States. I'm sure you all are aware of what's going on right now with all of the marches and rallies behind Brother Foster's murder at a time in our history where we know we need to separate. Now, before I go any farther, I want to talk a little bit about Sister Linda. Sister Linda, when I read your bio,
excuse me,
I was wrong.
I'm sorry, Sister Ann.
Yes.
Yeah, Brother Keith, the phone, that clicking, we have a clicking coming from your phone, Brother Keith. Can you move to a different area, or you might be near something causing some interference because we're getting a loud clicking from your phone. That's better. Whatever you did, solved it.
Okay, yes, sir.
Thank you.
Not a problem.
Oh, it's doing it again.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Is that better? Is that any better,
sir? You still
have
a clicking. Not now. It's not. But we'll just have to, make do.
There's still a clicking noise now?
It's better.
Okay, yes, sir.
All right, go, I'm sorry,
Sister Ann. Okay. Well, I was saying that I was just blown away by Sister Linda's bio. The things she has done. Now, from the U.S., she is from, of all places, Georgia, she told me.
That's right.
And she has, just been all over the place doing wonderful work. So, Sister Linda, I think
I'm
going to have you talk about some of the things that you have done. Now, Brother Keith, you hold on because I'm going to get to you. But talk about some of the things you have done in the States and then go on to Bermuda. Now, Sister Linda is in a very good position where she is able to tell us the difference in living in the States and living where she is now. So I'm going to let you have the floor, Sister Linda.
Yes, ma'am. All praises are to Allah. What I, first, I like to say, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, I bear witness that there is no God but He, and that Muhammad is His messenger. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity and the honor for being on the call this evening. I guess, you know, writing the bio was one thing, but, you know, oftentimes sharing it, I guess I'm a little bit hesitant or maybe shy. But so I've been in the nation since I first heard the teaching in 1980 and became a registered follower of Minister Louis Farrakhan, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad under Minister Louis Farrakhan in 1981. I didn't know anything about Islam prior to that time. I had some run-ins with the Muslims, but I didn't think I didn't know who they were. Like when I was little, my sisters would take me with them downtown to go shopping, and you know, when we get off the bus, everybody was all like uptight because the Muslims were on the other side of the street. And so my sisters would grab my hand and everyone would storm across the street. And when I got inside of the store with my sister, I would come back out with my quarter or 50 cent, whatever I had, and give it to the brothers for paper. Because I never wanted them to think that I was with those people who treated them so bad. And I was little. But they never, outside of that, who they were and who the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was or anything, the Nation of Islam, I had no idea. That was my view of Muslims. I mean, you know, black people who were trying to sell a paper. That's what they were to me. Eventually when I went away to college, I heard about Minister Farrakhan, but I didn't know that language, you know, Farrakhan. I didn't know who he was or heard of him. And so when he came to Morehouse to speak, I believe in 1979, I didn't go and hear him speak. And then eventually that next year, a friend of mine became a Muslim and told me, hey, Mike has become a Muslim. And I was laughing. I was like, tell him don't sell me no papers. I'm not doing it this time. But the next year, I had become a registered Muslim. And so all praise is due to Allah. So I came in Atlanta, and brother, his name is Sabir now. He was the minister in in Atlanta when I first came in 1980, 1981. And then I stayed in Atlanta because I was at school for probably about a year and a half, 2 years, and then moved to Los Angeles where I worked under Brother Khaled. I was a captain for a while, but always laboring, doing something in the mosque. And we just worked really hard back in those days in Los Angeles. That was, you know, right before the minister spoke and did the largest event that he had ever done on this side of Calvary, where 19,000 people came out to the forum. And, you know, it's always amazing to me because we worked really hard in Los Angeles. I mean, it's probably if some of those buildings are still up, Brother Halim put posters up on the buildings with flour and water, and they were up for years. So if some of those buildings are still there, they're still there. But we upset the Jews so badly by with all the work that we had done. By the time when they found out that it was Minister Farrakhan who was coming into the city, they were just outdone. And then we set the pace because they had, you know, written so many articles and, you know, been so upset about it and, you know, voiced it. By the time he got to New York, that's what was the impetus for so many people coming out to Madison Square Garden in New York, and 55,000 people, 5,000 people in the overflow. And so, they decided that if you were in the nation at that time, they decided that in New York, the Jews in New York decided that they were not going to say anything, that the Jews in L.A. had made the mistake by advertising Minister Farrakhan with their anger. And so they were going to say nothing. So, but it didn't work. It just made it three times more. But then after that, I stayed in L.A. I pretty much grew up in the mosque in L.A. And after that whole forum event, and all, I was at the dinner table. The minister had been there, and I was helping out at the house where he was having dinner. And afterwards, Brother Wahed asked me and another sister, what contributions did we want to make in the nation? And so I was kind of quiet. Maybe he's talking to her, you know. So I was, like I said, I was still young. I was under 25 still, I think, at the time. And then finally he turned to me and asked me, and I was interested in like international relations and, you know, doing, you know, setting up businesses and that kind of thing. And he encouraged me, and he told me that the minister had gotten scholarships for us to travel to Japan. And I applied, contacted Brother Akbar, and I applied for the scholarships with Brother Seho Tajiri. Maybe he helped the Honorable Elijah Muhammad get fish from Argentina, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
So he was connected to the Institute of Morology in Japan, and they had a university and elementary and high school called Leitaku University. And I went there for a year and studied. And actually, I got a four-year scholarship, and that's one thing in my life that I regret that I never did was I didn't stay there for the four-year scholarship. I was so ready to see black people. The day that I said, "Ooh, he's cute," I knew it was time for me to go home. I was like, "Cause," but I did travel a lot in the nation. I did get around a lot, and I did do a. I just volunteer for everything. The nation is so exciting. I don't know how anybody could be bored in the nation or not have anything to do, because it's always something
right.
to do, and it's very exciting to me to be a part of the Nation of Islam. And I think that's three things I always say. That reason why I'm in the nation is because they answered all my questions about Jesus. They talked
yes.
about a strong black family. And the third mm-hmm. thing is because of the hype. I just love the hype. You know, it's like, it's so exciting. So here I am. So,
okay.
So,
okay.
I know that's not the end, but, you know, well, inshallah, I'll do great things. And, brothers and sisters can hear more about me. But I do have some things on the drawing board of inshallah, books, cookbooks, some research that we've been doing on the Navy bean, inshallah,
oh,
can come
great.
Out soon. And
okay.
so I just try to do whatever we need, inshallah, to make our nation better.
Okay.
So
great, great. Now, Brother Keith, do you want to chime in and tell us about you?
Yes, ma'am. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
First of all, I just want to say thank you by the grace of Allah that we're all here to be able to share knowledge, wisdom, and understanding and life experiences. And with that, I would just get right into it so I don't waste time. This came as a surprise to me. I was asked by somebody, would I do this interview? And I just didn't mind. So I'm going to get right into it. I have an older brother, three sisters, and I'm the youngest. So with that being said, most people can understand that living in a black family where mother and father always have to work, the brother, three sisters, and me being the youngest, is always the oldest watching over the youngest. But I was able to find a lot of loopholes and a lot of ways where young black men get in trouble or find mischief.
Uh-huh.
I say all that to say that I'm going to cut this story real short. I say all that to say that I was introduced to the nation in 1996 when I was visiting Atlanta, and I met a friend of mine. She was always into Farrakhan. And it's like, I was like, who's this guy, like this radical type of guy? And I never really paid it no mind until one day I was invited to a mosque meeting. And Brother Jamil Muhammad was speaking. And I can remember I was sitting in the mosque. Now, before I entered the mosque, you know how they search you down. I was like, sort of like, I'm not sure if I really want to be here. But when I went in the mosque and sat down and listened to Brother Minister Jamil Muhammad speak, it's like he spoke right into my conscience. And right then and there, I was interested in White Black History, Knowledge, Wisdom, and Understanding of Self. And I decided that this is something that I wanted to do more research on. I didn't jump right in right away because I'm not one of those people that are easily led or follow. I'm one of those people, I do my research first. So upon doing my research, I found out that this is real. And it's like, it was enough for me to devote myself to what I believe is the truth. I mean, this is the absolute truth. There's no other, there is no God but Allah. I mean, for all those that are listening, I can bear witness that there is no God but Allah. I want to say that coming from Bermuda, where we differ from America, from birth, we're taught mannerism. Because we are always been a country or a little island, 21 square miles, a population of 60,000 people. Mannerism is key. And we're taught that from birth. One of the main things they teach us, your parents would teach us, that when you enter a place, you open your mouth. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. I like to say that, unfortunately, though, as time passed by, a lot of the things that we see going on in the world, especially in Bermuda, is things that, in my opinion, that we pick up from America. And it's it's like a mirror image, if you will. What goes on in America, it's only time and space before it affects us here in Bermuda. Before I go any further, I just want to say, I just want to shout out to two people that have kept me on this path, and I'm really appreciative. And if they're listening, I would like to say to Brother Minister Razul Muhammad, I'd like to say thank you, because he was the head over the 7th region when I joined when I registered in 1997. And I'd like to just say thank you to my big brother, I love you, and to Sister Clara Abdullah. She was the study group coordinator when I had registered, and it's through these two people, and as well as Sister Giselle Muhammad, that got me heavily involved in the Nation of Islam. A lot of the things that you see going on in the world directly affected Bermuda, because it's almost like America's little brother or little sister, if you will, in the effect of whatever goes on, whatever policies or whatever actions they take out, it's like, I'll give you an example. We are 21 square miles and a population of 60,000 people. So basically, everybody knows everybody. Everybody is family. So if you have a reputation, good or bad, everybody knows you. If you would have said to me maybe 10 or 15 years ago that there are going to be people getting shot and killed and murdered in my 21-square-mile island, I would have never believed that. But such is the case due to our influential... Man, sometimes I just have to take a break there. Sorry, I'm on
because
what's going on in this world, it's hard sometimes. It's really hard to really digest. It's hard to relate to. It just seems surreal at times. Even with this latest killing, it's if you could just imagine if, you know, this happening in 21 square miles, the effect that it would have, you know, that it has on us, you know. We have
right.
a system, and I mean, and I'm going to speak out because a lot of times, a lot of things get swept under the carpet. Bermuda, like everywhere else in the world, we have our racism and our racist issues. You know, I was a person that started out unsure of what I wanted to do and be in life. So I just took up a trade. And one thing about Bermuda, before we followed or patented our education system after America's, we had what we called we had primary school, which was from age 5 to 11 years old, and secondary school, which was from 11 to 16. And what we found in Bermuda is that, and this is amongst most blacks, especially when I was going to school. I'm gonna tell you my age. I'm 49 right now. So, but I was in primary school and secondary school before they switched to the middle school model. We was graduating from school at 16 years old and going right off to college, heading right off to college, and by age 21, most people were coming back to Bermuda with their degree and starting their own businesses or starting, you know, positions in top jobs at, like, age 21. So we had, like, some of the top tradesmen throughout the Caribbean. Trades were taught in all secondary schools. Also, and that was for the males. For the females, we had all sorts of, like, clerical, cookery. We had sewing classes. We had things that you was able to fall right into the system. But slowly but surely, because of us being so productive and progressive as blacks, it seems like slowly but surely these things, institutions were removed from us. Our trade school was removed. They had switched to a Americanized school system with the middle school and the, you know, we patterned our education system after America's, which is no real surprise why it's a failing education that we have here now.
Right.
And if you apply yourself, you will get something out of it, but you can only go so far with what you're given. But we were always taught a trade, and it's like. We're at 40 years later, we're at the bottom of the barrel. We have some black-owned companies, but not as predominant as it used to be. It's a predominant, the whites in the construction industry, basically. They took over Mazda City farmland. It's pretty much the exact same pattern as what you see in America, but it's on a smaller scale.
Okay.
And so it could be difficult at times. One thing I must say where we differ as Bermudians down America is that we have a lot of pride. We are very serious about family. We're very, very serious about raising children. We're very serious about chivalry, mannerism. All of those things have been sort of embedded and ingrained in us from birth. So you're used to people that are very, very friendly. You know, this was once a tourist economy, but we switched over to the exempt companies and, you know, that pattern, that model. So, you know, I tell you this, per capita, Bermuda is the most expensive place in the world, period. And you're talking about a place that's only 21 square miles. And it's like, when you think about just the survival alone, and especially with this pandemic, sometimes I wonder what this island really is going to come to, you know? Because you have a lot of people out of work right now, and it's we're trying to figure out how we're going to get this economy back going. And every country has their debts, what they have to deal with, but one thing Allah has, like my brother Ishmael said, has arrested the whole world. And this is a time that if we don't submit, if we don't get prepared, what they say, if you don't listen, you're going to feel. So, I mean, a lot of people are feeling the effects now, and a lot more of us are going to feel the effects. But, I mean, for the most part, Bermuda is a very peaceful, beautiful country, very picturesque. The people are very friendly. You don't have outright racism like you do in America. It's no fear of walking down the road and a cop harassing you or beating you, or we don't have all of that type of stuff in Bermuda. It's pretty much a friendly place, but I mean it's the disparities between America and Bermuda is like night and day, but yet on the flip side of the coin, we follow so much of what you do, you know?
Mm.
I don't know if you have any questions.
Okay. I'm sure we will. Now,
yes, ma'am.
I need to correct something. I said Foster, but his name is Floyd, George Floyd.
But yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I misspoke. Now, Sister Linda, what do you see in St. Croix as some of the primary differences in lifestyle?
Well, St. Croix is one of four inhabited islands in the U.S. Virgin Islands. It includes St. Croix, St. Thomas, St. John, and Water Islands. There are a few other islands, perhaps some with a few people living on it, but those are the main four islands.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to St. Croix, St. Croix was colonized by six countries and one, the Knight of Malta from England. But they were colonized during various periods by England, Spain, France, Holland, Denmark, and the United States eventually purchased it in 1917. So, of course, a lot of what you experience from the U.S. Virgin Islands is a bit of culture from all of those places. And St. Croix, with so many flags flying over it, or, you know, being occupied by so many, I mean, you have Spanish speaking here, you have French speaking here, you have people who have an inclination toward England or Denmark, and then, of course, toward the United States. It's pretty much the same on St. Croix, and then I believe that the U.S. Virgin Islands is kind of like a gateway for other Caribbean islands in the southern part or Eastern Caribbean area to come to get nationalized and move into the United States. So a lot of people are here in the U.S. Virgin Islands from Trinidad, Grenada, St. Lucia's, Nevis, you know, they're a little bit of everybody here from all over. So when I first got here, I've been living on St. Croix for 25 years, and when I first got to St. Croix, there were more people than not that would say things like, maybe they were just the ones who were saying it. Nobody else had an opinion or voiced their opinion at the time, but they were say things like, there's no racism here. You all come from the States with that racism and talking about that, but we don't have any problems with our white people. And but that's changed over the 25 years that I've been here, because more and more you see the disparities, and you see so many, for example, on St. Croix is the what you probably know of as the Hess refinery, but now it's been sold. It became Hovenza, and now it's been sold to what they call Lime Tree Bay. And but they, you know, so many people saw the racism who worked inside of the refinery. And, you know, just the disparities in income. If you lived on the island, you couldn't get housing or housing allowance. It was more difficult for you, where someone could come from the States who may be Caucasian, high school educated, and not as much experience as you. And now he's your supervisor, and he's making more money than you and more benefits than you had. So, over the years, there's been some, you know, more talk about, you know, just the disparities that local people aren't making the kind of progress that they want to make. And then education here, as Brother Keith was talking about, is terrible. And it's a combination of things. One is that we don't take in our own hands the education of our children. You know, we're waiting for the government to do something. Even though this government is a black government, I believe that it's a hidden hand behind what goes on in this government.
Right.
The U.S. Virgin Islands, it's when the U.S. took over in 1917, they appointed, I guess is the right word, is appointed, but or installed governors. There have been governors under the British rule, and they were like, it was still like a slave holding, you know, kind of. I mean, from the Danish, the Dutch were here in 1625, and then the Denmark was here from 1733 to 1917 when they sold it to the U.S. So from tours that I've taken with the Landmark Society here, the tour guides, I can't think of their official name, but they said that the Danish were the most brutal slaveholders out of all of them on St. Croix. And they said they set up two islands, I mean, two ends of St. Croix. Both of them had an area called Freegut. And that's where when blacks were eventually freed or they were able to buy their freedom, they had to live in those areas. And so a lot of who Virgin Islanders are today come out of this whole history of having been colonized or enslaved. And definitely it wasn't the slavery that we probably think about, although it was brutal here. It was very few Caucasians here. The governors were really responsible for kind of managing things, and there were people who were sent here from different countries to oversee properties that were here, and including the slaves. But it was very few, you know, of those compared to the number of blacks that were here. But the blacks were in such a condition that they were dependent upon, you know, whatever they could get, and was not until, I believe, emancipation get more organized in terms of trying to fight for their freedom. So the culture and the, you know, the way that we see our people today is impacted on by that. Is also impacted by the influence of the United States and people thinking that, you know, if I have more money, if I live in a better house, if I have a good job, things will be better. I'll be important. I'll be successful. This type of way. But then now too, as Brother Keith was saying, we have younger people. There are homicides here. I mean, we may say it's a small number compared to the urban cities across the U.S., but the population here is 100,000 people on all islands, totally, and 50,000 on St. Croix. So when 10 people get killed, that's a lot of people getting killed. That's so there could be less than 100 throughout the territory, but that's 1%, and it's less than 1%, but it's a lot. It's impactful still. And the fact that young people today, there's not really a place where they can get any training. They can go to high school, but there's very little training opportunities for them. There's very few opportunities where they can get a job. So it's just left to sometimes misunderstanding and being put in the alternative schooling and put in the youth rehabilitation center and eventually to prison. So, we did not escape. And sometimes I think about the question that you had raised about what, you know, you would hope that it would be something good coming out of being under a black rule. And there are some
right.
perks. People don't like you to say it. Like, there are some
right.
Benefits to membership. You know, like, you know, when you go into an office and it's all black people, and I probably would have never opened up a company if I was in the States. I mean, I wouldn't have had anyone to tell me, okay, go over there and do this and that. And they say, oh, you're trying to do this. Let me help you kind of thing. So there are some, there are benefits, you know, like you're encouraged to open up your own business because everybody's opening up and you may not have it all together or know exactly what you're doing, but, you know, that's taken into consideration. It's just that people are encouraged to move forward and, you know, be productive and do something. And so the first 3 years I was here, I cried because I didn't want to live in Macon, Georgia anymore. And that's what I saw St. Croix as, was Macon, Georgia. And, they're very much like living in Georgia. It is a small island. There are people, everybody's a family, and black people thing is that we don't forget what you did, even if you were a baby. If you did it, we're gonna talk about you forever. You can't ever correct that. You know, you just so and they, that's to people's detriment. Sometimes because you did it when you were 2 and now you're 32, you know, you got to go to prison for it, you know, so it could be at your detriment. But outside of that, I mean, you know, it can be, if you have patience, you can go far, but just like from the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad that I've learned is that we just have to love our people and continue to work with them and not take it personally because we're doing a work, but it can be challenging to hold that ground also, but we're just a mini United States, a country town in the United States. Yes, ma'am. So we have a lot of problems, but I guess that we have a lot of same problems that the United States had, but I think that culture and where they came from is a little bit different, and that's what's impactful. My husband is from St. Croix, and so I used to wonder, you know, after we got married in the nation and we were in Chicago when we met, so I didn't think about him outside of the context of the United States. We lived in the United States, and I thought, wait, we're going to stay here forever. And matter of fact, when it really dawned on me, like, he's from the Virgin Islands, I said, do you want to go back there? And he said, no, we're going to stay right here. And 3 weeks after we were married, he was headed back here, and later I was too. It didn't really dawn on me that there was a difference. But as we, you know, the first year of marriage, I was like, it's something different. And I think it's the pressure or, you know, what's going on where you live, you know, the culture or,
right.
you know, how you deal with things, the things that you're being impacted on. That's the thing that makes us different. But, you know, we're still the same people, but, you know, there are some things that I could say to my friends that I grew up in Georgia. I mean, I don't have to say anything to them because they know. We can just kind of look at each other. It's the same thing here. It's the same thing in other islands. You know, we just know. We know about Mr. Sam and Miss Lucy and, you know, that kind of thing. We know those things. We don't have to talk. It's unspoken. We don't have to say it. We know the whole history. We don't have to repeat it again. And so it's the same thing here. That they, you know, they have a common history. And those who grew up here, those who are from here and everything. And you don't, I mean, I've done a lot of work to try and find out what happened and what people's opinion about things are and how it impacted them. like anything else, anybody's history, you know, people don't want to talk about it. It's very sensitive and very personal to them. And though they were that kind of way, you know, 50 years ago, they don't want to be looked at like that anymore.
And right.
They interfered in the liberation of their people, or they sold people out, or this kind of thing. Who wants to talk about that and they're still living?
Right.
You know, so, but the, you know, one thing I like to bring out too is that I was in a farming class that for new farmers and everything, and one of the presenters came and he talked about a company. I can't even think of the name of the company now. It escapes me. But they owned a lot of farm equipment. They owned trucks, new backhoes, tractors, everything. This was like right in the 1920s, I think it was, 1920s, 1930s. And when they went out of business, they broke down all of this equipment and threw it in the ocean so that black people would not have an opportunity to farm.
Oh, man.
So here, these are the kind of things, you know, people are impacted on, like farming here. If we don't have our own well, water, we have to get agriculture to bring us water so that we can farm. And if you're doing that for 10 people or 50 people or, you know, however many people, you know, it's a challenge to farm, you know. So it's not, and you don't have money to buy tractors and get them shipped from the United States here, you know. So the agriculture has to come and plow the land, you know, till the land, you know, cut the grass. You have to cut the grass. And then they will come and do the other steps. So it's not easy necessarily living on an island. It's not the easiest thing when you're talking about people who are not necessarily independent. And that's, you know, I think what has happened to our people in most of the islands is they're not 100% independent. They're dependent on England to do, or the U.S. to do, or whatever other country to do. So they are definitely, as Brother Keith spoke, very family conscious, and I mean, just like any family, it has its they have their problems in family, but it is still the same type of model where we're dependent on the enemy to do something for us that we could be doing for ourselves. We're not very, we're not being the producers that will get us to freedom. We're not working on that level. We don't, like, for example, in the U.S. Virgin Islands, we import 98% of all of our food. So as the stores shut down in the U.S. or the farmers stop farming in the U.S., we won't eat. Farmers don't produce enough food here to eat not one island, let alone four. You know, we cannot feed that population. So people are already, you see people in Home Depot or wherever there are seeds, buying seeds, and they're planting something. But it's getting hot and it's a drought, and it may or may not make it, some food does grow, and there are some what they call starvation food, like, that we know about. So, you know, people know how to make it because they've had to make it under these kinds of conditions. So I think, you know, in a nutshell, Sister Ann, I think that the difference is that the similarity is that they're colonized by the same people that those of us who live in the U.S. are under. So you can imagine that there are some similarities in that.
Yes.
The thing that is different is that the pressure that they've been under, being isolated on an island, has made them into a rigorous training for everybody, because you got to do something. You have to do something to survive. You got to learn, you know, what grows here that you can eat, and definitely what you can't eat, because some of those things will kill you. You got to water in most places are in cisterns, so we don't have housing. A lot of housing does not have public water or potable water. We have cisterns here. And if you don't know what a cistern is, it's a concrete pool up under your house. And you pump water out of the cistern throughout your house. And I have one. I have two cisterns. One is 3,000 gallons, or I think it's 3,000, at least 3,000 gallons. The other one is 20,000 gallons of water.
Okay.
So we cook with propane gas. I don't have an outhouse, but I did experience that in Georgia.
Okay. Well, Sister Linda, we have a few minutes left. I'm going to ask Brother Carlton if he has anyone who wants to ask either of you a question.
So Dr. Ridgely is on.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Dr. Ridgely?
Oops. Yes, something like that.
Well, they can respond.
I don't have a question. I have a comment. So is that okay?
Yes.
In particular to the brother from Bermuda. I just want to let you know, Bermuda is the reason, one of the main reasons that I decided to join the nation in 1971 in New York City. And this relates to something about the change in atmosphere that I hear you all talking about that's happened in those islands. I was there at the end of 1970 or the beginning of 1971. I came there when I was with the National Black Theater out of New York. We went there to perform. Time to Rise, that was the name of the performance play. And anyway, when I flew into Bermuda, that was the first time that I've ever been out of the country. As I flew into Bermuda and saw that beautiful, clear water around Bermuda, I said, "This is heaven." And when I get off the plane, there was a sister who was our host who greeted us. Her name was Ntombe. And I fell in love with Ntombe. You know, I was like, 19 years old. And it was a beautiful, so beautiful on the island. And but I didn't feel the pressure of white people. I saw white people, but I didn't feel no pressure, no tension. I didn't feel like they felt like they was, you know, bigger than me. You know, I didn't get that pressure that they thought they could dominate. Now, remember, this is 1971. Okay. However, when I flew back into New York, when the plane got into the New York Harbor, flying over the East River, the Hudson River, it started getting gray. The water started getting gray, like the Sphinx in the in Hades, in the Inferno, Dante's Inferno. And I could see the planes dropping soot from the back onto the skyscrapers, which in my mind became the dungeons, the prisons. And lo and behold, this one blew my mind. You know, I had been studying, trying to understand and decide whether I was going to join the Nation of Islam. You know, I studied many things as I could about different religions and the teachings of Abu Elijah Muhammad. And he called white people devils. Okay. When I flew back, when we got into the territory, I actually saw white folks rise up as though somebody had an air hose and blew them up. And they rose up and they looked around and they looked at me and they looked around and in their eyes they said, "Okay, nigga, we back in town."
Wow.
This is America. Wow. This is ours, nigga. Now, all the time, in Bermuda with those white people. I didn't feel that. But time they felt that they was at home, they actually, I mean, it was like a, they rose up and they gave me that look. And I said, I'll be damned, this is hell. And immediately I said, the teaching of Elijah Muhammad is 100% true. And I had fallen off one of the motorbikes and I had scraped my hand while I was in Bermuda. And the fresh air was and the salt water and everything was clearing it up. Right? I didn't even put a bandage on it. After coming back to New York, I went. I stayed with my brother, and while I was going to College of Columbia, and I went to sleep. And about 3 or 4 hours later, I woke up and my hand had turned green, from gangrene.
Wow.
Just from living in New York for four days after getting back from Bermuda, and I had to go to Harlem Hospital and get a shot. And that was it for me. I joined the Nation of Islam under the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. So I'd like to thank Bermuda for giving me a taste of heaven to realize what hell was when I got back.
All praise due to Allah.
Yes, sir.
You
know, that's true. I'm sorry. It's true, though, because I stay here. The first 3 years that I stay here, I cried. Then the next 4 years, I kind of like was at peace. It was only because I didn't want to live in a small town anymore. But after the seven, you know, during that 3 to 7 year period, I decided that this was going to be my home and I wasn't coming back to the States, because it's definitely, you don't feel that type of pressure, except for the pressure from our own people. But if you go home and never go down the hill to talk to them, they won't bother you, you know, kind of thing. Just stay out of sight, out of mind, but not the anger or the hatred that goes on in America. You don't feel it, and it does give you an opportunity to think. And I have made it's a road. I'm not born yet, and I think people forget that. Both in the States, a lot of people don't keep referring to me like, aren't you from the Virgin Islands, as if I'm from here, but I'm not. So I think I've just been down here for a long time, and it's fewer people who know me in terms of being in the States. But
right.
It's kind of a dream, though, Dr. Ridgely. There are some problems that need to be worked out, you know, like economics, education, not much like with farmers, not much has changed as a result of the United States taking over in 1917 from the Dutch. I mean, the farmers got a little bit more land, but they don't have any resources to really farm. It's still a certain
democracy
that's in
one
charge
minute,
of everything.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to say that this had been an amazing show. If our guest if you will agree, we can continue this discussion next week, because
yes, ma'am.
I'm sure there are a lot of people on who have questions and comments. So we'll continue this discussion on next week. Is that all right with the two of you?
Inshallah,
yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Brother Carlson. Brother Carlson, do we have anything scheduled for next week?
Yes. Sister Sherry.
Right.
Sister Sherry is in the door. Yes, Sister Sherry. Not confirmed, but
Sister
Sherry. Sherry.
Okay.
Yes, for the
11th. We'll continue the following week.
Right. So next week is the 11th, right? So we're talking about the 18th.
Yes.
Yes, sir, brother.
Okay,
are you
no
interviewing
problem.
Sister Tasha, Dr. Visually? About Sister Tasha on the 18th?
Okay, then we got to make it together that.
Well,
the 25th.
We'll talk, Linda and Brother Keith. This has been a real eye-opener. And I certainly appreciate you all being on and being our guests. And we will
yes,
talk
ma'am.
And have you on again.
That's right,
yes, ma'am.
We will.
Yes, ma'am. So thank you all.
Thank you very,
very
much.
Okay.
Thank you.
This one. All right. I come late.
Lord, I've really been real stressed.
Uh-huh.
Down and out, losing ground.
Yeah.
Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic.
Mm.
Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go.
Uh-huh.
To let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone.
Alone.
I never at once felt so alone.
Alone.
I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel.
Uh-huh.
Not just my fair tire.
Down to P Street. Headliner, I challenge you to a game of horseshoes. A game of horseshoes!
Now I see the importance of history.